Hi, this is Eric Detweiler, and welcome to this, the 8th episode of Zoogma. Today's episode is, well, a bit less unified around a single concept than most of our others. We're going to cover digital activism, the concept of failure, strategies for incorporating technology into the classroom, and the risks that come with such incorporation. Throughout our coverage of these various topics, we'll see how segments and discussions about various media resonate with each other. In short, we'll be trying to mediate between media, or as we further abbreviated it for this episode's title, multimediating. A pessimist might call this episode scattered. But we're going to take the diversity of its content as a challenge, and one that seems particularly germane to the first main segment of today's episode, an interview with Dr. Rita Raley, Associate Professor of English at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Dr. Raley visited the University of Texas in February as the keynote for the Digital Writing and Research Lab's annual speaker series. Following her talk, which was entitled From Creative Cloning to Where Next? Tactical Media as Speculative Practice, Dr. Raley sat down for an interview with DWRL Assistant Director Trevor Hoig. What follows is a collection of some highlights from that interview. The full version will be published in the upcoming issue of the DWRL's online journal, Currents in Electronic Literacy. Our cut focuses especially on some of the pedagogically relevant sections of the interview, with Dr. Raley doing... student activism, as well as potential classroom implications of her research. After that, we have a special guest segment from Ryan Truman and Harley Ferris, both PhD students at the University of Louisville. They discuss strategies for implementing audio assignments in undergraduate writing courses. And finally, we talk about the risks and failures that can come with integrating newer technologies into the classroom, gathering some stories of such failures in order to argue that they're worth the risk, even potentially productive. And we'll try to weave some connections between these segments as we go. Even if our intentions fail, we'll at least hope to produce something else.
Welcome, everyone, and thanks so much for joining us. My name is Trevor Hoig, and I'm an assistant director here in the Digital Writing and Research Lab at the University of Texas at Austin. Today, I'm excited to be talking with Rita Raley, who is an associate professor of English at the University of California, Santa Barbara, as well as a visiting professor at the University of New York. Dr. Raley, it's great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
I'm really excited to get started, so let's just dive right in. Given that the theme of this year's DWRL speaker series is digital activism, and or more specifically, questioning digital activism, and the title of your lecture later today is Tactical Media as Speculative Practice, I thought we could begin just by talking about digital activism more broadly and then maybe work our way towards talking about tactical media as a specific form of intervention. Does that sound good?
That sounds wonderful.
All right. Recent social movements all over the world have employed digital media. For example, the Egyptian revolutionaries used Twitter, and in the U.S. and all over the world, the Occupy movement used everything from memes to live streaming video, you name it. As someone who works at the intersection of things like the digital humanities and media and rhetoric, like, I was interested in what you thought about which of these different practices were the most effective, say, especially from a rhetorical angle, and which ones seem to just to work and have produced powerful effects?
So I think that question can only be answered contextually or specifically with regard to the concrete circumstances of a particular situation. So a student protest on a particular campus even would want to employ different rhetorical strategies or different tactics or techniques than a student protest at a campus in, let's say, the UK, or even, you know, one can imagine differences among institutions in the US, of course, as well. I think probably one always has to ask, what does one want? What is the desired goal or outcome? Does one even want to be thinking in terms of goals or outcomes? Does one simply want to make some noise and get some attention? Is it about actually becoming aware of one's own power to act, in which case that would involve using entirely different techniques? I think the most powerful, and this is a generalization, it can only be that, but the most powerful movements, and I'll think in terms of student movements for a second since we're on a campus,
right,
have been those that have used a variety of techniques that have involved street action or quad action, banger hanging, leafleting, culture jamming or identity correction, memes, flash mobs, sometimes even dabbling in DDoS, although that's been less prevalent in student protests. But those that that in a way have more of a tentacle-like approach to the problem, and they're not thinking strictly spatially, this quad mm-hmm. or this green. They're not thinking strictly with regard to a single target. We want to take down this server or this particular figure, although we have seen a lot of that with chancellors and provosts and presidents being the subject of attack or criticism. But they're thinking in a very hybrid fashion, mixing what you might call digital and non-digital, though I don't even know that we need to think in that kind
right.
of binary fashion.
I was curious what you thought about the presence of media interventions that aren't working for the quote-unquote good guys, mm-hmm. so to speak. And, you know, for example, I haven't looked at it myself, but apparently there's, you know, a thriving community of white supremacists online and mm-hmm. things like that. And so I was curious, you know, how do we both protect the right for of speech and the right for media intervention and things like that, but at the same time sort of curtail the use of media for problematic ways? And I'm sure this also ties into the question of access too.
Yeah, I mean, certainly one would have to say that there's no ideological kernel or ontological core of a particular technological artifact or even of a technique. DDoS attacks are not inherently good or bad. That would be my claim. They can be used for good or bad. I mean, we're using these sort of stark terms, but you know, we're reminded always that these issues are framed in terms of the bad or the evil, and we're meant to feel that it's scary, a threat to the state,
right.
etc. I don't think inherently it is, but it can be used for these purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm more interested in patterns and structures of use than I am in thinking about the inherent value or quality or again, aspects, identity of any of these particular tools or techniques. So yes, white supremacists may very well avail themselves of the same techniques as anonymous. And it's all to be expected. And,
right.
and I think one just has to find new ways of combating or new ways of negotiating or navigating what one feels to be injurious acts or injurious speech.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a very rhetorical way to look at it too. I mean, if you think about like the ancient world, you know, the whole idea is, you know, the sophists teaching people different forms of intervention. It's sort of value neutral mm-hmm. in some profound sense that, you know, you don't tell people how to use it. It's just, there's a tool there. And so it sounds like you're interested in that deployment
mm-hmm.
more than anything else.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's the only way that one can think about these things in these terms. I mean, certainly the law, and I just mean that with a capital L in a general way, would want to categorize something like a DDoS attack as inherently bad. An act of terrorism is usually how it's framed,
right?
But why not frame it in terms of electronic civil disobedience? It could easily be spun in the
mm-hmm.
same terms. I don't think one can make a metaphysical claim one way or the other. You can make a legal claim, but
right.
I think that is always contextual.
Mm-hmm. This is closely related. I know you're very interested in teaching and pedagogy, and I was really interested to pick back up this thread of digital activism, tactile media, et cetera, and its pedagogical role. Like,
mm-hmm.
so for example, Greg Ulmer talks about this idea of electricity and becoming electronically literate.
Yeah.
And I was sort of interested in, you know, as a teacher and teaching with games and other types of media, like, how do you approach that? How do you approach media as a pedagogical intervention and in terms of its use, things like that?
Right. So this might be one of these throat clearing gestures, because I think one of the ways you frame the question in the list that you gave me earlier was about the sort of techniques that I think it's most important to impart to students? Or what do I feel, what qualifies as electronic literacy at this point, which I have strong feelings about. So I want to say something about
this, if you don't mind.
Yeah. I think search is crucial. But I also think data collection and privacy are crucial. I think students need to be aware of how they're being, of how we're all being tracked and monitored, how we're positioned, what types of information are regarded as valuable, how one can anonymize, if so desired, how one can craft a persona. This is always important with the in the age of social networking, how one can think about presenting the self, to use the Irving Goffman formulation. And, you know, in a very sort of ordinary sense, this will be important for students who go on the job market and realize their employers can look at precisely that crafting of the self over time. But if I were to just sort of enumerate, then I think search, issues of privacy and data valence, and then the third having to do with the presentation of the self.
Just for personal reasons, I want to pick up specifically on one of those lines. There was the idea of perceptibility, because, for example, I'm, you know, being so interested in memory and forgetting, I'm interested in this idea of becoming imperceptible online and making the net forget you and things like that. And so I was curious just to hear a little bit more about what you were doing with that.
And yeah, I looked at some of your classes and I saw you were doing the delete text as well, which I also taught at a certain moment. I think it's I taught it in a class on social media, important for students to think in these terms. And of course it has that shock effect. You know, you present certain anecdotes and they realize it could be them.
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
But it's important because it makes them realize that narratives can be constructed of the data that they are creating. In other words, they're not wholly in control of their data. It's, you know, it depends on the search query one runs. They can be produced as a dilettante or a deviant, right? Even though they might think of themselves as being wholly in control.
Oh, yeah, for sure. One of the things that I thought was striking that you make, I think, you make this very clear, is this idea that we've entered certain global economic and other conditions, say due to neoliberal capitalism, that makes it so it's really problematic to take, say, a classic revolutionary model and be like, tactical media will bring about some grand eschatological revolution that will be the end of history, et cetera. It's very ephemeral. It's it's very much about swarming and quick interventions and things like that. And I was just curious to hear you say a little bit more about that distinction about, say, media as disruption, and what about the world we live in now makes this really, in some ways, the only alternative we have.
Right. But I think there are other ways of acting or intervening or engaging, let's say, with power. I don't think this is all anymore, but I don't know that it ever was. But this is how electronic activism, and I'll use that phrase because it's from the Rand paper, an early Rand paper in Athena's camp. This is how electronic activism is framed in terms of disruption. It's disruption and destruction. And it's about asymmetric power, of course. It's about maintaining a certain kind of anonymity. And then, you know, the power from maintaining that kind of anonymity, as we know from Anonymous, this is still hugely important, right? But I think there's been a really pronounced turn to making, to maker culture, maker communities, DIY. Tactical media always invested in workshops and pedagogy, as I've suggested, as many of people have documented. But I think there's a strong turn toward what you might call more long-term thinking or community investment, rehabilitating housing projects, rehabilitating buildings, inner cities, and so forth. And I think there's a turn now so that disruption is just one tactic that one can use. And in a way, what I think is interesting is the way that disruption gets situated alongside of or in dialogue with or in solidarity with other types of practices that you might call affirmative, that have to do with building communities, building networks. The development of alternative networks has, of course, been hugely important. Alternative systems of exchange. So, yes, disruption certainly one wants to think in terms of guerrilla attacks, finding the system punked, to use the Galloway and Thacker phraseology, you know, exploiting the system. But I think that has to happen in concert with the forging of connections, broadly conceived. And again, I would think of that in terms of making or building. You know, what's interested me lately is the proliferation of these how-to manuals and the guidebooks. So Anarchist Cookbook, of course, is old, but in the last few years, there have been so many. There's a Toolbox for Revolution, Beautiful Time, I think it's called, Living as Form, et cetera, but they're instructive, and they're consciously instructive. And what's interesting is that art activists who are known to refuse prescription, are known to refuse that mode of the formula, are featured. And they will happily suggest, not best practices, to use that corporate phrase, but really what it is a kind of relaying and documenting of experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think it's important that a knowledge base is being developed. That, of course, one wants to have all the kind of skepticism that one would about prescriptive guides for action as being circumscribing and so forth. But as we know from ARGs or gaming more generally, instructions can be interpreted more liberally. There's a gap between the instruction and the execution.
Right.
And that gap is all. That's where, in a sense, agency is situated.
Once again, if you're interested in hearing the full version of that interview, keep an eye out for the upcoming issue of Currents in Electronic Literacy. You can check out our website, zugma.dwrl.utexas.edu, for a link to Currents, as well as the full audio of the talk Dr. Rayleigh gave during her visit to the lab. A link to the full video of that talk will also be coming soon. For now, there was a particular line in Dr. Rayleigh's talk that struck a chord with many of our lab members.
Tactical media is speculative in that it does not predict, prescribe, or program future outcomes. It rather activates, sets into motion, unsettles the status quo. It adheres, moreover, to the logic of the prototype, the alpha version, made to test a concept with the expectation of bugs, kinks, failures, and the knowledge that the thing itself might not be actualized.
As rhetoric and writing instructors, many of us were intrigued by the implications of this line for our teaching practices. Lab member Scott Nelson, who was live-tweeting during the talk, put it this way. Perhaps all pedagogy should be alpha version, radically creative, full of bugs and crashes. That may sound like an unsavory prospect, so in what follows, we offer two approaches to such techno-pedagogical risks. First, our guest contributors from the University of Louisville help anticipate some of those bugs and crashes by offering tips for incorporating audio assignments into writing classes. Next, we try to help assuage the anxiety that can come with pedagogical risk-taking by talking with some lab members who have experienced technologically mediated failures of their own in their classrooms. Though we strive not to be unreflective apologists for new media and technology, as some of our stories of failure make clear, we offer these segments in the hope that they'll serve as encouragements to leave room for those bugs and crashes, rather than playing it safe and missing the conversations, lessons, and remarkable student work they can make possible.
I'm Harley Ferris. I'm a first-year PhD student at the University of Louisville.
And I'm Ryan Truman, also a PhD student at the University of Louisville. We thought we would start the discussion just by choosing some point of departure that our audience has access to. Not that the audience has read it already, but it does exist out there. It's a post that I wrote on the Scholar Electric blog. That's scholarelectric.org. And the title of the post is Incorporating an Audio Assignment into Your Classroom. That audio assignment that I talk about incorporating into your classroom is a public service announcement. The reason I chose a public service announcement, there are several reasons, but one is that when I help out at DMAC during the summers, one of the first assignments that we use to get people introduced into thinking about interfaces and composing outside or beyond merely the alphabetic text is public service announcement.
When you when you talk about a public service announcement, the PSA that we see as it lives in the real world, as it exists in the wild, always has, and you talk about this in your blog post too, about the stakes. You know, what's at stake for these people? And, you know, how, when you pull that into the classroom, do you set is it just a simply contrived kind of scenario, pretend you're so-and-so, or do you connect this with something in the student's world?
Well, when I'm designing an assignment, I always try to think about how that assignment fits into the larger arc of assignments in my classroom. I try to have one assignment build into the next assignment. And so when I use this PSA assignment, usually it's attached to some sort of research that the student is doing. But it has to be something that they're invested in researching. And so part of that research, I assign that they have to go looking or they have to respond to some very specific questions that I have about the research that they're doing. Some of those questions are crafted in a way that's going to help them construct a certain type of PSA because the generic demands or the generic conventions of a PSA generally follow a set pattern, right? You begin by saying, hey, here's this problem, this statistic, and here's what's at stake. Maybe here's who I am, but not necessarily. And then here's a solution. Here's a way to think about it, and here's what you can do. Go do that, right? It's pretty simple, and there are all sorts of variations on it. But once, you know, as an instructor, you start to understand what the conventional demands are of the genre, then you can help students research more efficiently so that they've got those bases covered when they get to it. But additionally, students don't necessarily come into contact with PSAs all the time. There are plenty of them on Facebook, but you know, we're focusing on the oral ones, so these ones will come on the radio. They'll be on NPR. And so every once in a while, you'll hear, I'm Eddie Vedder speaking on behalf of whatever, and here's a statistic about animal cruelty. Here's why that's a horrible thing. Here's a phone number to call, and then some tagline that's memorable telling you to go do it. Once students realize, oh, that's what I'm researching. Okay. And then you can engage them with their research because they are moving towards a genre that they're not necessarily experts in, but they at least have a sense for what they are, how they operate, and the fact that something like this does actually exist in the world. They've run across it, thought about it. And it's not a way of making assignments more vital to students. It's just a matter of establishing a relationship between students and their assignments in a slightly different way than I used to.
You know, something I really like about that is the way you talked about providing the different pieces. And I would do something similar, but what I would do is I would give them options within those, and maybe you do that and just didn't mention it. But instead of there being, here's everyone's music, you know, here's a set of 15 intro pieces, choose the one that's most effective. And so that would always, again, be pushing back to why this piece and not that piece.
How would that work if you gave them, like, would you give them 15 pieces?
Well, I might. You know, if we're going to say, here's your music, here's your template, then it's definitely a construction process. I want the student to learn how to physically construct, you know, digitally, these set of items into something that resembles a PSA. For me, being able to give somebody 12 to 15 different 20-second clips of music, and then ask them to say, you know, to find which one of these resonates with your project, gives us a place to discuss, well, why does that music resonate with your project? You know, what about it? Is it because it's in a major key, or is it because it's in a minor key? Does it feel happy, sad? Is there a lot of instruments, or is it very minimal? Because I'm looking for then this sort of juxtaposition. You know, why this with this? And when you put these items together, does that reinforce your message? So I don't want it to just simply be a rote practice of then, okay, now I know how to do this. Because the next PSA that you make, you might follow all those same steps, but if you have a different message, then maybe you should have chosen different music, because that message won't be effective if you're following the template without a decent awareness of why I'm choosing the elements I'm choosing.
When you introduce an audio assignment into your classroom, or when you think about doing that, think about different types of audio assignments you're going to be introducing into your classroom. Do you tend to incorporate orality or the audio aspects towards the end of the composition process?
No, I don't. And I would think about it from the front end for a couple of reasons. We would begin by talking about the affordances. You know, what can sound do that video can't, or that images can't, or that alphabetic text can't? And that would be something we would carry with us at every single step. So we would be talking, we'd be listening to examples. Even before they know what their assignment is, we would be analyzing other people's, other examples. The point is that we would develop a vocabulary and a set of terms that we begin using to explore these different sound artifacts that exist. Then, as we talked about an assignment that would rely on sound as its main mode of delivery, then we would use all of that same terminology that we've cultivated to reason out what's the most effective way to deliver my message.
So it sounds like you focus a lot on the choices and the appropriateness of having chosen audio as a means of delivery.
Right, and it's kind of the extension of the idea of rhetorical grammar, so that this is not a set of rules, it's a set of choices, that I can break a rule if I do this here because I'm doing it for a specific effect. I feel like this is kind of an extension of that we can put anything we want. There's a place for every sound. There's a time to have a really pristine quality recording, and there's a time to have a really crummy lo-fi kind of sound. Each of those have effects. So what are those effects that we're trying to evoke? And given that, you know, understanding what our project is and what we're trying to accomplish, and then having an awareness of the range of options available to us and what their affordances or effects are, then we can intelligently put together a more persuasive piece.
I listened to you explain why you might include, 10 or 15 pieces, and I think, wow, that's such a great idea. And then I turn around and say, but I'm not going to do that. I'm sticking with my one piece.
Right.
And it's not because your idea is bad. It's a great idea. What's really great about it is that your choice to include so many really align with what you value as an instructor, what you want to engage your students with. That's not to say I don't want to engage my students in thinking about the music that they choose. It's just that I don't have unlimited time. And there are certain things that, as an instructor, I want to focus on and that I think will connect to the next assignment that I've got designed for the course.
No, I was just going to say that I agree. That shapes the way that we deliver an assignment like this. And it also shapes whether or not we even deliver this kind of assignment at all.
You know, you and I are talking about some very different approaches to different aspects of incorporating an audio assignment into your classroom. I think that just goes to show how much an audio assignment has to offer as a viable assignment choice in someone's classroom. They're so rich. There's so many opportunities to talk about rhetoric, to talk about writing practice, to talk about modes of delivery, to talk about all these things. We could go into all sorts of ways of justifying historically or rhetorically or socially, but maybe the simplest justification is that it's just so rich and can accomplish so many of the things that traditional writing assignments already can, as well as expanding the options for engaging our students.
And giving them tools to create new meaning with a different set of semiotic resources.
That was Ryan Truman and Harley Ferris, both PhD students and writing instructors at the University of Louisville in Louisville, Kentucky. Check out our website for links to supplementary materials, including the wealth of information on Truman's blog, The Scholar Electric. And now, on to our failure narratives. We should offer a final caveat before jumping in, however. We are very fortunate here in the lab to have a robust infrastructure of people, software, and hardware to help facilitate our adventures and misadventures in teaching with technology. And we know that this certainly isn't the case in many higher education settings. But even if it just means making use of the audio recording software that comes pre-installed on many smartphones, assigning students a few YouTube videos to watch and analyze, or playing around with document design in a word processor, we hope you'll be encouraged to look for opportunities to draw on media and technologies besides linear text. If you're interested in more specific lesson plans designed for a variety of classroom settings, check our site for a link to the lab's lesson plan repository. For now, we begin by talking about the concept and affordances of failure with one of the lab's project leaders, then segue straight into our narrative segments.
My name is Kendall Gertis. I'm a rhetoric PhD student at University of Texas at Austin.
And I have bothered you here today, Kendall, to talk a little bit about failure. And I'm here to ask you about a book that I myself have failed to read. The book we are going to be talking about is
Judith Halberstam's Queer Art of Failure. So Halberstam is taking up failure from the queer studies or queer theory turned towards negativity and negative affects. So antisociality, forgetting, stupidity, and failure. Halberstam's argument is that failure is a queer art, and that queerness entails a certain kind of failure at what is established as the norms of success by a kind of heteronormative culture. And so to be queer is to fail in all these ways, but those failures are also what gives you access to this different kind of life. Halberstam is careful never to say that failure is a good thing or a bad thing, but that it's always mixed up together. But the end of the book does sort of exhort readers to find a certain kind of promise in failure as a way of life.
I mean, would it be fair at all to say that failure, like, produces something?
Yes, failure is definitely productive here, but it's productive of something else other than success. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely not that simple flip, right? But it doesn't stop it from doing things and making things.
So maybe one way to get our listeners a little bit more attuned to this conversation is to look at a specific example Halberstam uses in the book of failure, stupidity, or these other sorts of tropes you talked about.
So the second chapter of The Queer Art of Failure is called Dude, Where's My Phallus? Forgetting, Losing, and Looping. And Halberstam reads a couple of pop films, including Dude, Where's My Car? As an example of the way that stupidity and forgetting where your car is and being culturally insensitive and generally a dumb white man makes other things happen. And so stupidity is productive of these alternative forms of knowledge that the characters in Dude, Where's My Car have to rely on in order to get through their sort of Groundhog Day that then they have to keep repeating. And so it's their stupidity, right, that alters the way that masculinity plays out in the film. It alters the way that gender and race play out in the film. And Halberstam says, I do believe that if you watch Dude, Where's My Car slowly and repeatedly while perfectly sober, the mysteries of the universe may be revealed to you. So Halberstam's arguing for not only reading what's interesting about our cultural representations of failure and what those tell us about the other kinds of productions other than success that failure makes available to us, but also for reading failure in not just representation, but in culture.
And so I'm going to go out on a limb here to sort of connect us back to some of the other stuff we've been talking about in this episode, which is sort of the potential failures that technology, especially social media and what Rita Riley calls tactical media, can sort of open up in the classroom. Do you think there would be any potential resonances between the way Halberstam talks about failure and a pedagogical practice that would sort of leave itself open to failure?
Well, I don't want to be too specific to technology, but I think that teaching and failure are certainly connected practices. So what Halberstam might give us insight in terms of the teaching of rhetoric, or teaching in general, is that your failures produce something other than what you intended. And it doesn't mean that they're worthless, or uninteresting, or even embarrassing, or worth discarding. In fact, all of that logic is the logic of the normative. I think the connection between failure and teaching is about doing something unexpected, right? Doing something that you couldn't have planned to teach in advance, but that doesn't mean that it's no longer teaching, right? So failed teaching is something else, right? But it's not, you know, trash. It's not something we should discard or attempt to eliminate necessarily.
I'm Stephen Lemieux. I've been here at Texas for a couple of years now. I've been in the lab the whole time, and I've been teaching in computer classrooms for, I guess, three years now. But the first time I did it, I was in a classroom where all of the computers were situated as pods. And I thought, okay, this seems okay. Maybe some group work could go on. They can talk to one another. And also, at the start of that year, I made a decision, kind of a nice firm decision, that I wouldn't police their activity. I wasn't going to say, hey, don't look at Facebook, don't check the news. I figured they're adults, I can trust them, it's their education if they want to listen. It was trouble. So as the year wore on, I started to notice more and more that I could see students kind of clicking around the internet. I don't know, some news, some Facebook, etc. And more than that, though, was just the trouble with the room, because the way the pods were situated, I had half the students with their backs to me, kind of looking at the screen, supposedly to take notes, right? The other half, of course, were looking at their computers and then me. I felt throughout this entire semester like I never quite had their attention, that the computer was always right in the middle of it. And so the class I was teaching was kind of an introduction to electronic literature, to digital media. I don't know, as the year wore on, I started to falter. I started to say, Stephen, maybe you should demand their attention, but I don't know, I wanted to take it up as an experiment, so I figured I'll just run the year out, let's see what happens. And never again. never again, both with the pods, because really, the pods, I couldn't get any group work done, because if computers are arranged kind of around the classroom, they can still clump up in their chairs and whatever, you don't need those pods. Mm-hmm. And so it just made it impossible to have like a full class discussion. It made lecturing difficult. The only thing it actually worked real well for was when in class we engaged the electronic literature. And so, I mean, that was just because we had computers there, it worked just as well. Mm-hmm. Some other trouble that I've had in these digital classrooms, and more so in classrooms that are focused on digital material, was that I fell into the trap of assuming a certain level of digital fluency in my students. Kind of the old digital native type deal. And in that class, I had them play very simple interactive fiction games and go through a wide variety of electronic literature. And I thought, okay, these are adults, maybe 18 to about 20. I figure they've had computers since they were little. They should know how to do these things. But no, I mean, the very first time you tried a piece of interactive fiction, it was a disaster. I mean, some of them sat in the very first room of this piece of fiction. It starts, you're in a hut. There are a couple things on the wall. And they want you to pick a knife or pick a medicine bag. So you would just type in, like, medicine bag, mm-hmm. and then you'd get the medicine bag. But these poor students just had no idea what to do. So they sat in this initial room for probably, like, half an hour. They would type in, like, look. It would repeat the same message. And so a lot of them would just keep retyping this, kind of the old, I'll try it till something different happens. But no, nothing different would happen. Some of them would type in help, and it would give them kind of a lot of different things that they could type in. And so they would kind of run through the help file and say, look at this, or move. And so a lot of them would try and leave the hut, but the game wouldn't let them leave until they picked one of these objects. And so yeah, what I found that we had to do was I couldn't quite rely on them to work through the pieces of Elit on their own at home as normal course of homework. Mm-hmm. And so I started to get in the mode of spending the first 10 or 15 minutes of class looking at this literature, spending some serious time on the e-lit, kind of walking them through how we can engage these things. And so it's actually really interesting because in the end, the course, or at least its focus kind of turned toward how do we learn to read, mm-hmm. and how do we learn to read differently when these pieces of, say, interactive fiction or electronic poetry or electronic literature, how do we read these things if they're completely foreign to our normal course of business? And so it's actually nice because it gave us a chance to relearn how to read.
My name is Scott Nelson. I'm assistant instructor at the University of Texas at Austin, where I work in the digital writing research lab as a visual media specialist.
Actually, I fail all the time, especially working with technology. You have to be like prepared for failure. I was just talking to someone the other day about the worst presentation I've ever given, in which my slide resolution was completely off. And so I pulled a Bill O'Reilly, I'll just do it live, and decided instead to just explain what the next slides would have been, and there was no audio in the video, and so I had to explain what the clip meant. And I think working with any type of technology, failure is just part of the design. Like, you have to be ready and be on your toes for that. As a visual media specialist, I do a lot of consulting work in other instructors' classes. And one that comes to mind recently was Rachel Mazeek's class on the rhetoric of disability was creating videos to argue different points. And they had all uploaded their videos to YouTube. And so a lot of my research deals with intellectual property. And what happened on YouTube was that the content ID system flagged about half of their videos for using copyrighted content, meaning that when the class went to share their videos with each other, half of the videos were locked down. And I noticed this when Rachel had posted the links on Facebook, and so I contacted her about what had happened and how to fight automatic content ID takedowns and how to make that into a learning opportunity. And I've actually gone into another Rachel's classroom to talk about video argument, Rachel Schneider. And much of my time in there has been talking about fair use, public domain, YouTube's content ID system, and how to actually create a fair use claim. Because I know that when the students upload their videos, because they're using copyrighted material, they're going to end up getting flagged. And so I've actually incorporated it into my lesson plan for her classes that they will need to learn about fair use so that when they are flagged and automatically taken down by the content ID system, they can mount a strong fair use defense of why their video is protected under fair use guidelines. So I think that preparing them for this type of run-in with an automated system is extremely important, because not only is the system itself learning, but if no one fights against these types of claims, then you have a machine doing all of the sort of copyright decisions rather than society and determining that balance between owned content and content that's fair use or in the public domain for the progress of science and the arts.
So my name's Lynn Coles. The last class that I taught was literature and philosophy in the English department at UT, which was great. So I was in my classroom. I taught at 8 o'clock in the morning that semester, and I was with students in the classroom when one of them got one of the emergency text messages from the university that said, "There's a gunman on campus. Everyone stay where you are." And so as soon as we got one of those text messages, we immediately stopped class. We were teaching rhetoric at the point. So I was teaching rhetoric, and I had someone actually in from the writing center to teach about the writing process. And so I was in the classroom with another instructor, and we all of a sudden had to deal with this kind of tragic circumstance. The thing that was the most problematic at that point was that everyone in the classroom had internet access on their laptops or their phones with their parents. There was like just immediate connectivity to the outside world that was really inappropriate in a classroom that you're trying to like keep locked down for the sake of security, for the sake of mental stability and students who had like friends and stuff all over campus. And so like information control or the regulation of information flow was really like the thing that we were trying trying to make the most happen at that point. Like, we all really, really needed to make sure that, like, nobody was freaked out by the amount of information that was coming into their phones or out of their phones at that point. So I had some students who were trying to, like, contact media outlets because they wanted to, like, be on the news at that point, you know? And so we just at some point had to, like, cut everyone's cell phones down and say, like, look, we're stuck in this situation together, and technology is not going to make this any easier for us. So what we have to do is just, like, deal with this as a small community and then figure out tomorrow what's going to happen on the larger scale. So it ended up being a really, really valuable and growing experience for our classroom because we sat for, you know, 3.5 hours together and just dealt with the news as it came in. So the regulation of information flow, like, as far as, like, the creation of technology goes, like, that it was a really important step at that point because there was so much information coming in and going out. There was no failure of information, but it was like we had to make information fail in order to make that classroom work at that point.
All right, this is Hala Herbley from Zugma Podcast, and I'm talking to
Hampton Finger, Systems Administrator for the Digital Writing and Research Lab.
He sees all the technology failures that we teachers sort of have happened to us. So I thought I'd ask you, Hampton, what is the most interesting technology failure that you've witnessed?
Well, there are the common ones. There's the, I can't get sound. Is it plugged in? Oh, no, it isn't. Okay. You know, those kind of silly stuff that when you get up in front of a class, your brain just turns off, right, except for the task at hand, and sometimes technology can be befuddling.
Right.
But the biggest pedagogical fail I have ever been a part of, there was a training session for a content management system we use. I was in the room, in the back, wanting to just be sure to be there to help. And I was asked to leave before the technology session started. And so this is a teacher teaching teachers how to use the technology. And within 5 minutes, I was frantically called back into the room because the technology wasn't working the way it was supposed to. But what's funny is that the instructor didn't know actually how the technology was supposed to work, and it was working exactly the way it was supposed to, but they didn't know how to use it. But a lot of it is just forgetting the basic stuff of computers, save early, save often. Rely on your friends. Rely on everybody. There is no stupid question at when it comes to technology. If you don't know what a button does, push it. And then if it does something completely crazy, we're here to help. You just have to ask. Pride is dangerous around technology.
Right.
Because people will do silly things without further saying, should I do this?
Right.
That can cause problems.
So we should embrace the idea that we are going to probably fail at some point and then be okay with that, which will then allow us to ask for help?
Yes.
Okay.
The computers, they will fail in new and interesting ways at the least useful time.
Right.
In the early days of this lab, sometimes the computers wouldn't even boot. And it's always a teachable moment. There should be a teachable moment somewhere.
That's it for this week's episode of Zugma. This week's episode was co-produced by the Spring... That's it for this week's episode of Zugma. This week's episode was co-produced by the Spring 2013 Zugma team. Axel Bowman, Eric Detweiler, Paula Herbley, and Andy Uzendowski. Special thanks to Rita Rayleigh, Ryan Truman, Harley Ferris, and all of this episode's other guest contributors. For more information on episodes, you can visit our website, zugma.dwrl.utexas.edu. You can follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. You can download episodes via iTunes or Liberated Syndication, dwrlpodcast.libsyn.com. Check back in a few weeks for our next episode, Eating, which will feature a variety of delicious approaches to the rhetoric of food.